This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Patrick M. Wood. He is editor of the August Forecast and the August Review. He's author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. He's founder and executive director of Citizens for Free Speech. Patrick, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Where are you located?
Mesa, Arizona, actually. Out where it's hot and mostly dry.
Fantastic. Well, you know, when they talk about the heat in Arizona, I used to live there, and, you know, it's a dry heat, so it's not so bad.
That's what we all say.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, hey, this is a fascinating topic, and your book is just fascinating. You really just cover so many areas of life, of business, of... I mean, it's just so wide-ranging. But first of all, the word technocracy, where did that come from? I mean, when we were talking off air, I tend to think of it as kind of a new thing. And from the angle of the tyranny of these tech companies abusing their power. But how do you mean it in the title of the book?
Well, exactly. Technocracy, if you look in the dictionary, it simply means rule by experts, by scientists and engineers. But historically speaking, technocracy with a capital T was a system of economic thought. Actually, it was an economic system itself that was designed in the early 1930s at Columbia University in particular. And that was during the heat of the Great Depression, of course. Many people thought capitalism was dead. And the scientists and engineers at Columbia rose up and said, hey, we can do better. We can do something different. Let's invent a brand new economic system because capitalism is going to die, and then we'll waltz in and we'll put this in place and everybody will be happy. happy, I guess. But capitalism recovered. Technocracy kind of went to the wayside, and it stayed in the wayside for years and years until the early 1970s when it began to raise its head again. And today we have a lot of evidence that this original system of technocracy is in play today and still, you know, still knocking on the door trying to replace the economic system that we know and grew up with, which is, of course, free market economics, capitalism, free enterprise, whatever you like to call it. So this is you know, the great concern today on technocracy is if somebody wants to meddle with our economic system as it has been for the last hundreds and hundreds of years, that's fine. But how about let's just have a real discussion about it to decide, is this really what we want to do or not?
Well, you know, I guess the question of is it good or bad, we have to dive into this in more detail. I mean, it doesn't seem like we have any experts running the world nowadays. So in some ways, I'd welcome some experts. But, you know, we've got all these folks that have been sitting in government for decades, and they just keep making the problems worse with their maybe unintended or intended consequences, I'm not sure. And they're pushing for just more and more power under the guise of giveaways, handouts, socialism. Are they considered experts? I mean, what the technocracy, who that we all know of would be considered an expert that's like running the world today? Would it be Sergey Brin and Jeff Bezos, or would it be Zuckerberg, or would it be like a government official? We tend to think of it as government, I think.
That's right. The common tendency to kind of look at government politics via the government is pretty natural because that's where all the conflict and stuff is. Economics is, you know, the whole area of economics is just boring to most people. And it's like watching the paint dry, you know, in your bathroom or something. Just, you know, to get me away from here. But it's a really an economic issue. It's not a political issue. The original technocrats believed that politicians were incompetent, probably mean-spirited, and they hated their guts. They wanted to get rid of all the politicians altogether and simply create an org chart for scientists and engineers to run the country. This, of course, was, you know, pretty preposterous according to, you know, just based on our Constitution, the political structure we have. But these people really believed that they could do a better job than any politician. Well, that antipathy still exists between technocrats and politicians today. In fact, a lot of people are mad at politicians today for the same reasons they were in 1932, because they looked at as bumbling fools and, you know, illogical and that sort of thing. And there's good, I think there's probably pretty good reason for that. But the technocrats themselves today would look down their nose at the political system and say, you know, it's just flat out busted. It's broken. It's broken beyond repair. Why don't we just get rid of the politicians and listen to science? The mantra today of science says is kind of like Simon Says, the old game we played when we were kids. It is the dangerous thing here. Science does not always say what society should do. That's why we have elected politicians, or supposed to anyway. Mm-hmm. So you look at like the Jeff Bezos of the world, you look at the Eric Schmidts of the world, the Sergey Brins of the world, and so on. These people most definitely would be considered as technocrats. They are not Marxist, for, in my opinion. I've studied this quite a bit. I don't look at them as Marxist at all. I look at them as technocrats. They're using technology to promote the science of social engineering, as they call it, where they intend to engineer society and the people in society for their own, you know, proprietary economic interest. And this is not really what America bargained for. In the COVID world today, we see people like Anthony Fauci, for instance, standing behind the president with his white coat and his arms folded, mostly looking down his nose. And he would like to basically just say, look, this, just follow my policies and don't worry about anything else. But here's the problem with this whole.
So Fauci would be considered a technocrat.
Absolutely, okay. So. And there's a host of people like that who think that they know better how to run society than anybody else. Mm-hmm. But here's the deal: the people like the Faucis that caused the great panic of 2020, as I call it. You have to ask the question: who in the world, in the history of the entire planet, who in the world had the power or the strategy to shut down and destroy the entire global economic system? This has never happened before in the history of the world.
Right.
And most people aren't paying attention to it because it's kind of economic in nature. Well, you know, okay, big depression coming, that sort of thing. But these people have had an axe out to kill capitalism and free enterprise ever since the early 1930s. And they're still doing, they have the same motive today that they had back then. And, you know, as I write about technocracy today, I say this is the clear and present danger of today's world. We need to really worry about these people, because why are they so intent on destroying the economic system of our planet and our country in particular? People understand what's going on here, but you and I probably understand it's going on in the whole world right now. It's not just America.
Yeah, no, it is. Well, I mean, why would they rush to destroy the economy and so many other things? Well, of course, it's always to gain power and gain influence and gain wealth. And when these kind of things happen, there are huge transfers of wealth and power. I mean, they're giant in their significance, especially now, and we're continuing to see it. I mean, maybe you can unpack that a little more.
Well, absolutely. I think about this a lot. And because of my background, I'm kind of syncing up with what you just said here. The United Nations has been the torchbearer for technocracy for ever since 1992, for sure. But probably before that as well.
What happened in 1992? Internet?
Well, what happened in 1992 was the Rio de Janeiro conference that spawned, that was the United Nations big global meeting, that spawned the so-called Agenda 21 and sustainable.
That was Agenda 21 was 1992, huh? I've done some shows on that before. And so maybe you can just tell everybody quickly, what is Agenda 21?
Well, it was the agenda for the 21st century, but the key thing to it was it brought out the economic system called sustainable development. That is a resource-based economic system. instead of one that's based on supply and demand and you know, a price moderated economic system like we know and understand today. A resource based economic system is based on controlling the resources and controlling the consumption of people who consume those resources. So it gave birth to sustainable development as a doctrine, as an economic policy, which was identical, as I've documented in my book, to the early technocracy movement in, from the 1930s. But the head of climate change a few years ago did a press conference in Europe. And she was the head of climate change. Her name was Christiana Figueres. She was the one that drove the Paris Agreement meeting that resulted in the big climate change pact across the world. She said in this press release, or this presser, and this is a direct quote from her lips, she said, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." We don't have to read between the lines to figure out what she's talking about. Mm-hmm. She's got this new economic model. The old economic model is inadequate. Mm-hmm. That's capitalism, free enterprise, free market economics. And sustainable development is the new economic system. And she says that the United Nations has an intention, has a time plan, a time frame, and also the tools to create this new economic development model, and it's called sustainable development. Well, this is antithetic to free market economics completely.
Well, they, you know what they say: green trees have red roots.
That's right.
And this red implying communism.
I know we see this today. You know, every revolution, by the way, has had its useful idiots. You know, we got that term from the Bolshevik Revolution, the useful idiots that thought they were doing good.
Stalin used to use that. Yeah.
They were the first ones that got killed after the Bolsheviks took power. Mm-hmm. And they well, what went wrong? You know, we thought we were helping you.
But, well, there's no shortage of useful idiots. Just go to downtown Seattle, downtown Portland, downtown Chicago. They're all over the place now. And, you know, we've had this school system that has just discouraged critical thinking. I mean, it's shocking when you watch a news program and you see people interviewed, or you go on social media and have a debate about anything. It doesn't matter what side you're on, what you believe. It's just the ability to think critically and to weigh both sides of an issue is just, that has evaporated. I mean, it has just evaporated.
Yes. And this is not, I don't believe this is by mistake. I've been following education in general for, I don't know, probably almost four decades now. And I have seen the intentional dumbing down of our education system. There's been books written about it by
I've interviewed them. Yeah. What were the names of those? I've had that guy on my show. Can't remember, but yeah.
I can't remember his first name. Gatto was his last name. That was one guy. Then there was Charlotte Iserbit that also did a piece on it, or a book on it. But this is legendary at this point. You know, the school system has been turned into a propaganda delivery system. It's not education anymore. It's not reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's not critical thinking skills. Yeah. It's not writing skills. It's simply a propaganda machine that brainwashes the poor children today into all this social justice, green stuff and, you know, love Mother Earth or whatever. And, kids cannot, probably there's three or four generations now of children who have grown up who absolutely are incapable of thinking beyond the end of their nose. They just can't do it. They struggle with every basic thought to get through it. And then they end up believing two different things at the same time and think it's okay.
I know. It's never understand that there are consequences for everything. So you're making a trade-off. Do you love humanity, or do you love Mother Earth, or do you just say, well, there has to be a balance between the two? You know, that humans have a right to be here too, just like all the other animals. And, you know, we have to have some sort of balance, but it's just so... I don't even know where to start. Well, so tell us about how transforming economics really, I think you've addressed that, right?
I certainly did. And I pretty much do it on a continuous basis when people are sensitive to economic issues, mm-hmm. because there's a sea change going on right now. And yep. most people haven't really seen the distinction because they don't understand the history of it. But when an AOC, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, stands up in Congress and says, we're going to have a Green New Deal, and then she promotes all this, you know, this sustainable development stuff that we're going to completely rebuild and transform America into something different. Everybody laughed at first. They thought, oh, you idiot, you know, get out of here. That ain't going to happen. And they looked at her as some kind of radical person. And she, it doesn't matter if she is or isn't. But the point is, since then, since she originally said, propose a Green New Deal, now all of a sudden, Republicans and Democrats are jumping on board. And they're promoting various elements, the Democrats especially, but Republicans are promoting many, many aspects of the Green New Deal now, and it's almost to the point of becoming mainstream. And what we see around the world now, I look at this stuff on a global basis. All of the stimulus money that's being spent today to fight the COVID emergency, you know, and the shutdown of the global economic system, they're trying to get it resuscitated again. This stimulus money is not being spent on traditional economic aspects that you and I would probably say that's what we should do. It's being spent on green initiatives. And in Europe, they're actually using the term Green New Deal to rebuild the economic system from the ground up into something altogether different than what we've had in the past.
Well, I mean, sadly, Europe is a disaster. I mean, no one could deny that. Listen, I was born in Europe. I, you know, usually go there a couple times a year, and it's just a disaster. I mean, Europe is over. It's a mess. Europe has basically, and, you know, of course I'm generalizing because each country is obviously different, but, you know, it has destroyed itself through big government, socialist tendencies, mass immigration takeovers and political correctness, where you can no longer even speak in some European countries. Literally, free speech is gone. And these are countries that consider themselves democratic countries. It's absolutely nuts. But that's happening in the U.S. We see that here, too.
But if you look at people, and you're right, Europe is a train wreck. But if you look at people like Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, which is clearly a global elite organization, yeah. And
I must say, as much as I do agree with you, I still, it's on my bucket list to go to Davos.
I would like to.
I want to be in the cool club. I want to go fly 1,100 jets to Davos, 1,100 private jets, so I can talk about the environment. Such right, hypocrites. It's right. Unbelievable.
Well, Klaus Schwab is leading the pack anyway today, talking about the Great Reset. He uses that word, that phrase, the Great Reset. And in terms of economic policy, whatever the Great Reset is, that should be of great concern to folks like you and I. What do you mean by the Great Reset? Because these are powerful people. They have a lot of influence around the world.
Sure.
And if they're planning a quote-unquote Great Reset of the economic system, then I want to know what that is. Could you please define your terms and tell me what you mean by the Great Reset? What do you think it's going to look like after it's done, if you can pull it off? And a lot of people look at this right now. But what Klaus is talking about is about this Green New Deal type of mentality where everything is going to be swapped over into a resource-based economic system away from the supply and demand. And here's the big issue on this. I think you'll grasp this immediately. Sustainable development was never really about fair market economics. That it just wasn't. But what it promotes is a resource grab. It's not a monetary grab per se. It's grabbing the resources. And everybody knows, you're in the real estate business, everybody knows historically, wealth is always generated from the ground. It doesn't matter what it is. Everything comes out of the ground.
The gold comes out of the ground, the silver comes out of the ground, the oil, the food, everything.
So if you control the resources, it doesn't matter what the monetary system is. You have the wealth. You have the control over, the humanity within your reach, because you can decide what happens with those resources. And so this, in my opinion, this has been a major theme, at least since the early 1970s, that sustainable development could be used as a platform by the global elite to grab resources on an epic scale around the planet. And for the resources that they could not grab directly, the United Nations has practiced for a long time now a policy of taking resources offline and simply declaring them to be, you know, vacant of human activity. Just stay away from it, like the heritage zones and stuff, massive plots of land that basically just been taken out of human protection.
Well, I'll tell you something. So when you say resources, you're pretty much talking about land, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So resources are land. Go ahead with what you're saying about that.
Well, things that come from, by extension, things that come from the land.
Okay, got it.
Oil, timber, the food, et cetera.
Sure. Years ago, when I had the brilliant Thomas Sowell on my show, during that interview with him, I coined a new term, and I called it environmental racism. And basically, when I lived in Orange County, California, Irvine, Newport Beach, some very nice areas, I would notice they dedicate all this land as permanent open space. And then the people that went and bought homes there, you know, all my nice white neighbors, and I'm white too. So, you know, it's just kind of, I'm noticing it and talking about it at least. But they would basically start circulating all sorts of petitions and getting activists about they got to dedicate more open space and more for the environment. And really, that was just to keep their property prices up or to drive them up and to keep people out, to keep others out, to make it inaccessible to other people of lower incomes. And so that's what's going on around the world. And that's Agenda 21 is like that. But the interesting thing about it is that if anybody considers COVID-19 to be some people are way out there and they think it's a total conspiracy. I don't think that. But it is an opportunity. If you're in power and you want more power, there are certainly a lot of power grabs going on. But this is doing the opposite of that. This is making people just spit in the face of Agenda 21 ideas, where people are going to the country and living in rural areas or car-based suburban areas. I mean, nobody's going to be interested in high-rise living and mass transit if you've got a deadly virus and a bunch of race riots going on in your city, right? Who wants to live in a city anymore? I mean, you know, that seems like it's an opposite current, right?
It does. And I have to say the flood of people leaving right now, just panicked almost, leaving cities, completely flies in the face of the global elite's predictions that there's going to be 75% or 80% of all the people in the world living in cities someday. And that's why we need to make smart cities and, you know, have all the monitoring stuff and everything connected with the Internet of Things to, you know, control everybody. They've had all these great lofty plans. And they're running a little bit off the rails right now, I have to say. And, you know, what they're thinking at this point is anybody's guess. But the rural communities, I have to throw this in, the rural communities, by definition, have already been included into the major metro areas as far as regulatory, you know, activity is concerned. And this is something that most rural communities do not recognize at this point. Agenda 21 and Sustainable Development, the 2030 Agenda, those doctrines, as rules are being set in place within a major city, they also are including in their master plan all of the surrounding rural communities as well. And so the regulations from the city extend out into the rural areas. I've studied this in California quite a bit. And you look at one plan for the Bay Area, and you'll see that it extends up into the foothills of Northern California, which is far, far away from the cities, all the way through all the agricultural land.
And those people, the irony of it is those people in the foothills and all these outlying areas have no voting power, and they probably don't have any money to go and lobby. So they'll just get overrun by the city slickers in terms of the regulation, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened. I grew up in Northern California, so I'm sensitive to it. And I know ranchers and farmers up there, and that's exactly the case. They, you know, they say, well, what can we do? You know, I mean, you know, we don't like it and we complain about it, but we don't have the voting power. We don't have the voting block. We don't have the influence or the megaphone or microphone to speak out against it. And so we're just getting sucked into it like a vortex, and we have no choice. But what people are going to find as they flee the cities to live in the suburbs or out in the rural areas, smaller cities, for instance, that maybe only have 5 or 10,000 people right now, they will find when they get there that many of the things that they fled will follow them. That's all. That's the only thing I would say. Maybe not immediately, but those same types of manipulative regulations will follow them. And I'm afraid already that some of these radical groups like Antifa and BLM have already said, well, they're coming to the suburbs, they're coming to the rural communities. And I don't know what that means yet. But
they've been in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and they are doing that. But it's hard for them. And so we'll see that. But all of these manipulative regulations and stuff, it's hard for them to be meaningful if you live in the suburbs or in rural areas. You know, so they might have regulations and restrictions, but it's going to be hard for them to enforce them or make it meaningful. I think the thing that the powers that be can do if they want to gain more power and really hurt people is they really need to control, and they already do control it in terms of the content of it, but they need to control like the speed of the internet and the access to information. And if they can make it so that it's hard to have good internet in rural areas, then that will push people back into the crowded cities where Agenda 21 wants them. That, listen, all the Green New Deal doesn't work without mass transit. Okay. You know, it doesn't work in suburbia very well. It works in cities better. You know, it works in high rises. It works in mass transit areas. It doesn't work in car-based culture. So right. That's the opposite of what they want, right?
Well, it is. And you know, it's interesting up in the Portland area, a few months ago, I don't know, maybe 3 months ago or so, there was 100 miles of street that were shut down for the sake of COVID. And I thought to myself at the time, I said, well, that fits right in with what they've always wanted to do is get all the cars off the streets and, you know, force people into mass transit and riding their bicycles and stuff like that. And I don't know if they ever lifted that ban on those particular streets, but it was kind of a humorous way to, well, it wasn't funny to them, people living there, I guess, but it was kind of funny to me that they were trying to fight COVID by shutting down the streets. And then they showed pictures of people riding their bicycles on these empty streets. And, you know, they're riding along. And of course, they, you know, they're riding in pairs and groups and stuff like that, which is just seems to be antithetic to think policies that would fight the disease in the first place.
Yeah, it's a crazy time. What does the Trilateral Commission have to do with all of this? And what is the Trilateral Commission? You know, there's this thing about presidents that have been members of the trilateralists, I guess. Yeah. I should say, or not. And like Reagan wasn't, and he had an assassination attempt. And it seems to immunize you from assassination attempts or something. Is that true? What is that all about?
Well, Trilateral Commission was founded by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski, kind of the Beauty and the Beast sort of a combination, back in 1973. And they drew members from Europe, Japan, and North America. Very elite members of the global economic community, the business community, the political community, legal community, the press community. And their goal back then was to create a new international economic order. And we debated, Tony Sutton and I debated members of the Trilateral Commission back in those days before they caught on to, you know, our critical stance on it. And they said consistently that they were after creating a new economic system in the world, that they were not interested in politics. And even though they had politicians in their membership, but what I discovered is that in spite of all the members of the Trilateral Commission who got into the political system, especially with Jimmy Carter, because Carter was a member, Mondale, his vice president, was a member, and most all of his cabinet were members of the Trilateral Commission. They weren't after capturing just running the political system. What they were after was getting their hands on the economic machinery that was represented by that political system. They wanted to get into a control situation over the global economic system in order to transform it. So, for instance, over succeeding years, 8 out of 10 of the World Bank presidents that the president appointed were members of the Trilateral Commission. You had 9 out of 12 people who were appointed to the U.S. Trade Representative. 9 out of 12 were members of the Trilateral Commission. The giant trade treaties like NAFTA and CAFTA were written by members of the Trilateral Commission. So this was about economics from day one. It wasn't about a political coup like a lot of people thought. And they have come and gone. Members of the commission have come and gone from government over the years. But I believe personally their goal is still the same. It's to transform the economic system. And it's
you keep saying transform, but what does that mean? I mean, transform it to resource-based, and it sounds like pretty much consistently globalism. Would you agree with that? Right?
Absolutely.
Globalism, which means the nations, they don't have the power. It's kind of like the states' rights debate between the states and the federal government, who has the power, right? Same idea on an international scale. But you know the thing COVID will do for the power-hungry folks that we're discussing? It will push us toward a digital cryptocurrency. And I don't mean Bitcoin. I mean a government-backed, central bank-backed cryptocurrency. China is doing it, and they have every excuse. I've seen several articles about dirty money, meaning touching coins and dollar and bills, that's dangerous. That can transmit the disease, they say. And they may well be right. And so it's an opportunity to say, hey, look, you know, we've got to make this digital. And then we will lose our spending privacy completely. And another thing, the last bastion maybe of privacy that's left is, you know, the ability to use cash and buy something without everybody knowing what we did, it will be lost. So that's, I guess if you're on a chessboard, I would call that check. And then if there is a global digital fiat money, if it's one currency, a world currency, that's checkmate. It's game over for the citizens of the world right there, because there will be zero privacy, and they could do what China is doing with this social scoring and literally just take your money away with a click of a mouse. And you could become destitute and starve, and, you know, your resources could be just completely cut off because you said something bad about the internet or wrote something bad on social media, you know, and not about the internet, about the government.
Right. This is one of the great risks, I believe, that we face right now. And one of my favorite topics over the years has been the Bank for International Settlements. And mm-hmm. I've studied them extensively in years past, and nothing much has changed there. But, you know, they are the central bank to central banks around the world system, mm-hmm. and they're very powerful. They have tons of influence on what happens in the world economically. And just recently, it's been revealed that the BIS is creating a series of innovation hubs, they call them, that they're putting around in various countries, including the United States and Canada and countries in Europe, to, as they say, plot the future of money. And these innovation hubs are lathered with money from the BIS, and their goal is to hire the brightest and the best, you know, computer programmers and monetary, whatever, cryptocurrency type people that are, you know, big on blockchain, that sort of thing, to come up with a digital payment system using AI and cybersecurity and all that kind of stuff that would be suitable for the entire planet. Now, individual central banks have been working on stuff for some time. Our Fed has the FedCoin idea. The Bank of England has their own little SWAT team of researchers who are working on digital currencies and so on down the line. China, as you said, has been working on it. But now the BIS, the elephant in the living room, has weighed in that they're putting a network of so-called innovation hubs together around the world to create an integrated global monetary digital system. And that's on the books now. We can look at that. We can study it. They've got papers out on it. And it's like, you know, I look at it and go, oh boy, here we go. they're weighing in on it. And you can just see where this is going.
If they control where people can build, how they can build, a home for themselves, if they control every body of water, a little pond on your property, if they control your money, if they control the energy you have access to, whether you're allowed to catch rainwater or not, consolidate all the tech companies so that they can control speech, which is what they're doing as a proxy for the government, the big tech companies. That's exactly what they're doing. That, you know, the government can't control your speech in the US, right? But Twitter and Google sure can, and so can Facebook. And so these big tech companies just become a proxy for government. You don't have First Amendment rights against Twitter. Okay.
No.
Yeah. You only have that against the government. So these are pretty crazy times. Last thing, I mean, we've got to wrap it up, but this has been an interesting talk, Patrick. Where's the economy going? And I mean, I know what you're going to say, you know, but it's a loaded question. But, you know, dice it up for us a little bit. It's always more complicated than just a question like that.
It really is. And the simple term would be, I think by the beginning of next year, there will be every attempt to kind of prop things up between now and the election. But starting in November, December, January, sometime within a 3 or 4 month period after that, I think the Great Depression too will be recognized around the world. And it will force governments to probably react again with new stimulus and how we're going to get out of this. And yeah, you know, I mean, who knows?
But I mean, no government wants that. I mean, all of the powers that be say that the reason we had the Great Depression was because we didn't do enough, right? So I think we can all pretty much bank on that the Fed and the government and other central banks and other governments around the world are going to stimulate as much as they need to. There is no tether whatsoever on the amount of money they can pump into a system. So if they do that, I mean, does that mean inflation? You know, when you say, well, there's going to be a depression, is that an inflationary depression? Is it a deflationary depression? Is it neither? These are nuanced issues for sure.
Well, absolutely they are. And it does make a difference. I personally believe that we'll be headed into a deflationary depression.
But why would they let that happen? Because they don't want deflation. It makes their debt burden bigger. And, you know, look at all the debt the U.S. has. Why would they allow that? They'll just print so much, they'll just create inflation, right?
Yes, that's right. But the cycles of inflation and deflation often have a life of their own. Once they're started, they often have a life of their own. And I think that's what's going to happen here. But here's my prediction as far as technocracy is concerned. What people will beg for in the end is answers and solutions to make society work again. And I can almost just see this in my mind today, that leaders and people, you know, on the street, Main Street, as they call it, will be begging for somebody to come along and provide solutions to make society work again. Just make it work and fix it. It's broken. Fix the society, get the crime off the streets, get the, you know, kind of get the economy going again. That will be the day that these technocrats rise up again, make themselves visible and say, we have solutions if you just but ask us for them. And we will come in and help you fix the system. Here's the case in point to back that up. Back in 1933, when FDR was just coming into the presidency, he'd been elected and he was yet to be seated in January. And the technocrats of that day actually published a book. And this was a big movement back then, by the way. There was hundreds of thousands of people who were card-carrying, dues-paying members of the Technocracy Incorporated movement across North America. They actually wrote a book that begged FDR to declare himself dictator once he got into office, to dismiss all of the political system, Congress, courts, everything, and simply allow those engineers and scientists to set up a structure where everything could be managed by them. You didn't need a political system, they said. We can do it. We can make it. Everybody's needs will be met and everybody will be, you know, they'll have what they need and they won't have to work so hard and, you know, everything's going to be good. Well, this is a Pollyannish dream, but the mean-spirited attitude came out with this demand of FDR to declare himself dictator. Say, holy mackerel, are you really? And it's not. I got this book. It's a rare book. I got a copy of it. I read it and about dropped my teeth. Well, we're going to be back in a situation similar to this at some point where people are simply not going to care about the political system in charge, whether it's socialism, communism, or anything. They're just going to say, look, can anybody come along and make the system work again?
Well, that's where we already have some degree of that now, certainly, and we've had it for, you know, a long time. I mean, they just create a crisis and then come in and rescue the people from the crisis that was created by government in the first place. So that's, you know, create a crisis, then solve it. And in they always gain more control. As they do every time they do that, it's another layer of additional control and additional wealth transfer. And that's exactly what you have happen, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, wow. I often refer to some of the Star Trek series that feature that race called the Borg. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people know what the Borg was, just science fiction, of course, but they had this this famous phrase, we will assimilate. And, you know, into the hive mind, we will assimilate.
Yeah, right.
And they grab people and all of a sudden there's technology all over them and they assimilated them into the hive mind. You know, this is the essence of transformation today, in my opinion. To look around the world, it's that this thing just keeps marching on. And basically they're saying, when we touch you, we will assimilate you. And this is exactly what's happened.
Yeah, that's the thing. Well, okay, wrap it up with what can anybody do about any of this stuff? It's so wide reaching and you know, it's just, there's just so much to it, but any action steps and then give out your website.
In 2018, I started an organization, nonprofit organization called Citizens for Free Speech, and that's citizensforfreespeech.org to promote and defend the First Amendment in particular. And we've kind of been touching on that during this entire interview, one way or another. Free speech is on the chopping block, as you know. The First Amendment is on the chopping block. And our ability to communicate, whether it's through expression of religion, whether it's through free speech or freedom of the press or the right to peaceable assembly or the right to redress the government for grievances, all of those things concern communication. And if we lose the ability to communicate in our country, we're done. Europe, you already alluded to, has no such thing as free speech anymore. You say certain things, you'll end up in jail. Mm-hmm. We're headed that way. And, you know, we have mounted a defense for the First Amendment and free speech through Citizens for Free Speech. Our membership is growing like mad right now with all the COVID crisis going on. And, you know, we're rapidly becoming a national voice for the free speech issues. And I would encourage people, if you want to get involved with something, to do something, go to citizensforfreespeech.org. It doesn't cost a thing to sign up and stand with us and say, yep, I'm done with all this other stuff. We need to start standing up ourselves and making our own voices heard in our local communities, especially.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So is that the website you want to share? Do you want to share another one?
So Citizens for Free Speech. Most people that might be listening would, if they know my name or the word technocracy, they will find my professional website, technocracy.news, very quickly. Been around for a while, and you know, we have quite a bit of traffic coming to our site every day. So people can go there too, technocracy.news, and follow along with the story, the saga of technocracy in the world today. And I bring articles from all over the world, actually, that have something to do with technocracy. And it's not what I say that I want people to see. I want people here to see what the other side is saying. You know, people like the Klaus Schwabs of the world and, you know, the AOCs of the world, whatever. You got to listen to what they are saying.
Right.
And if you do, you'll get an idea real quickly of what they have in mind to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Patrick Wood, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.